Hello, welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Stephanie Domingo.
I'm Tux Lerzel.
And this is a show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government.
Mm-hmm, sure is. We be drankin'.
And we be correcting.
That we do.
So in episode 8, I said that Grover Cleveland had a special bathtub made for him because he was a large man. He was a large man, but the special tub that was made was for... Taft. I liked that I didn't even write it down. William H. Taft. Yeah. He was the one with the special bathtub. Grover Cleveland was just the monster.
Yeah. He needed his special bath because he was garbage juice.
But yeah.
He didn't actually have a special bath built for him. He was a big man too, but not as big as Taft.
Yeah, not as big as Taft in stature, but bigger in his sociopath. Fitness?
Well, we don't know yet. We haven't investigated Taft.
Let me stop my lies already. I'm just like, I heard. No, yeah. I did not hear.
Taft was great. He was just real big, but yes,
right. He was big boned.
Yes. I guess next season we're gonna have to look into Taft.
Yeah. God. Yeah, this is the end of season one.
Season one of Beyond Reproach. Yeah, we're gonna take a little break for the summer. We won't be gone long, no. So don't get scared.
Yeah, don't you dare get scared.
We're just gonna take.
Oh God! Sorry, go on. You were saying something meaningful.
Yeah, we're just gonna take just a short break for the summer, just to sort of like, you know, this has been a real learning experience for us.
Oh God!
If you've been listening from the beginning, or even if you started later, but you have listened to all
it's
the episodes,
been a journey.
Yeah, there's a big difference between how things were going in the beginning and how things are going now.
Yes,
but we still think that there's a little bit of room for self-reflection.
There's
and growth.
Lots of room for improvement and growth.
We're going to take a short break.
Regroup,
and come back with hopefully an even stronger season two of Beyond Reproach.
Yes. We're going to come back with our old people voices. Yes.
When we're not doing Dolly Parton and Morgan Freeman.
We'll come back older and wiser two months from now.
Back in my day.
You're like, 1983?
Yeah. 2018. It's like, I don't know what that noise was. We hope you'll join us again at the end of the summer when we have new episodes out.
Yeah.
And we hope over the summer you will give us some written reviews on iTunes.
Yes, and follow us because we'll still have our social medias going.
That's true.
There'll be content coming out every now and then, just not new episodes.
Yeah. We do also be drinking, as we mentioned before.
Should we cheers
real
quick?
Let's do it. Oh, a real cheers sound today.
See, episode 10 is when we finally get our act together.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
Today we're drinking an Applejack-based cocktail called a Jack Rose. If you've never had Applejack before, it's a type of brandy made from apples, but it's not as sweet and fruity as you might think. Like, when I think of fruit brandy...
You think of, like, peach?
Yeah, I think it's going to be like that, like, De Kuyker's, like...
Yes.
Sugar syrup. Water that tastes peachy. But this is an actual brandy. This is like, sugar water.
It's super strong.
It does taste appley, but it's not, like, super fruit-forward.
It's like a hint.
And it's not sweet at all.
No, it's not sweet.
It basically tastes like an appley scented whiskey or something.
Yeah, it's very dry.
Yeah. So Applejack has actually been around since way back when we were just a collection of British colonies. And it's actually considered America's first spirit.
Hmm. Did not know that.
Yeah. Apples were among some of the first crops ever grown in colonial America. And hard apple cider was the most popular beverage in the country. Beverage, like non-alcoholic or alcoholic. Hard apple cider was the most popular beverage in colonial times in America.
Wow. Maybe because it had alcohol in it and everything was just so dirty.
Even children would drink cider. Because you couldn't drink the water. Like you would.
I'm just imagining how annoying it would be to have like drunk kids running around.
could be an interesting time.
Maybe they just fall asleep and then
that's why. Yeah, yeah, that's
mm-hmm. Maybe actually this is a
that's the way.
Come here, come here. No.
If I ever have kids, I'll have to keep this in mind.
Okay. I'm going to strike that from the record so ACS doesn't come and get you in the future. Okay.
So anyways, hard apple cider was the most popular beverage, but if people wanted something a little stronger, they would just take their cider and put it outside in the winter and let it freeze.
Okay.
And since alcohol freezes at a lower temperature mm-hmm. than water, they would just separate the ice crystals out and keep the unfrozen liquid Ooh. Left over, which was the alcohol.
Yeah.
This style of freeze distillation at the time was called jacking, mm. as in like jacking up the alcohol content, mm-hmm. hence the name Applejack.
Ah, okay. Wow. Very cool.
Back then, people usually drank their Applejack straight or occasionally as a scotchum, which was a mix of Applejack, boiling water, and mustard.
Ew.
Yeah.
Yuck. Oh, sick.
So we figured that drinking straight Applejack sounded like it would make for a really messy episode.
Yeah.
We had some messy episodes recently and decided we needed to keep drinking, but maybe scale it back just a little.
Yeah.
And I think that hot Applejack with mustard sounds kind of gross.
Sounds really gross. Not 100% chocolate gross, but gross.
Yeah. Part of me is tempted just to try it.
Yeah.
But not with a microphone in the room.
You know, I would have to finish it.
Yeah. And nobody wants to hear the noises that would come out of my mouth after drinking that. For those reasons, today we're going to be bending our own rules a little bit. While the main ingredient in the drink that we're drinking today is historically accurate for the era of my story, the actual cocktail wouldn't exist for another 100 years. I did also get us a few bottles of hard cider, just in case we want to switch it up a little bit. So the Jack Rose is made with Applejack, grenadine, and lemon or lime juice. It was referenced in print as far back as 1905, but was most popular in the 1920s and 30s, notably appearing in Ernest Hemingway's 1926 classic, The Sun Also Rises. It was also a favorite drink of John Steinbeck.
Hmm, okay.
It's good.
Yeah,
it's,
I like it.
I mean, it's strong because the Applejack. A note on grenadine, don't use just like the Rose's grenadine that you find at the grocery store. Real grenadine, which is what you should be using for this, is made with pomegranate juice. You can actually make it yourself at home really easily, but if you don't want to do that, you can find it online mm-hmm. really easily. Just make sure it says that there's pomegranate juice in the ingredients or it's not what you want.
It's but yummy. It's very tart.
It's strong. It's tart like from the lemon juice.
But you put bitters in it.
Yeah, there's some bitters in it too.
It's really good.
If you want like a link to some good grenadine to use, or if you want the recipe for the cocktail, you can check out the cocktail section of our website. And today, since today is the final episode of our season, we decided to change things up just a little bit. We will be talking about things that are sort of adjacent to politics and scandals, but not directly political scandals.
Or that's not going to be the focus.
Yeah. Yeah, there is definitely some scandal.
Yeah.
And some politics.
Exactly.
But that's not the focus. Yeah. To wrap up the first season, we decided we would choose a special theme for the episode. And today we're both going to be talking about some of the folk heroes of American foundational mythology and how their real stories are much more scandalous than the fairy tales we all learn about in school and that they would have us believe.
I'm excited for
this. So, speaking of Applejack and apple cider.
Yes.
Do you know anything about it, Johnny Appleseed?
I know that he is a man who had like some weird hat that kind of looked like a pot, perhaps. And he went around sprinkling apple seeds mm-hmm. and growing apple trees.
Yep. That's pretty the much end. The base of like, most people's knowledge, yeah.
It's like I could draw a cartoon of him, but mm-hmm. I don't really know. Yeah. Was his name even John? I hope it was.
It was John,
okay,
yes.
Good. Yeah. Jesus, because you never know.
Yeah. So his story has been reworked, retold, and romanticized over the years, perhaps most famously in a segment from a 1948 Disney feature called Melody Time. That's when he was really sort of transformed into this cartoon instead of a real historical figure.
Yeah.
And
it's funny, my story has like a Disney element too.
Really?
Yeah.
There was a lot of that in the 50s.
Yes, exactly. The 40s 1955. And 50s. Yeah.
So because of all the cartoons and stories about him, a lot of people don't even realize that he actually was a real person, but he's not the person that we thought he was. Fictional character or not, most of us grew up thinking of him as this sort of quirky, selfless loner, traveling barefoot around the American frontier, planting apple seeds from a big bag of seeds.
Yes.
So that future settlers would have a wholesome food source when they got to the frontier. In reality, he was much more of a capitalist land speculator
no!
than a selfless champion of the apple as a nutritious food source.
Wow.
In fact, the apples he was planting were never even intended for eating. Beyond all that, though, he was also a total nutjob.
I have so many questions already, but yeah. Go on.
We're just okay, going to power yeah, through this. Yeah. Hopefully I will answer most of your questions okay. throughout. So beyond all that, he was a total nutjob. While his obscure religious views may have had a lot to do with his signature quirkiness, his strange behavior may also have been caused by a touch of light brain damage.
No! Yeah. Oh, wow. This is great. Good old light brain damage.
Light brain damage, yeah. I thought you would appreciate that.
It's like a free app on the iTunes store.
L-I-T-E.
Yes, exactly.
Brain damage light.
Yeah, I don't want the full one because I don't want to pay $4.99.
So before I get into the story of Johnny Appleseed, though, I need to talk a little bit about apples in general.
Okay.
So apples were a huge part of the European, quote, settling of America, and they were a major part of the economy by the time that Johnny Appleseed was born. But would you know what it meant if I were to say apples don't grow true from seed?
No.
Okay. In the world of biology, apples are classified as extreme heterozygotes, which means that their seeds are biologically different from that of the parent plant. In other words, if you were to plant an apple from seed, the tree that grew from that seed would bear completely different fruit from the apple that it came from. In fact, 99% of the time, apples grown from seed are basically inedible. And in colonial America, they were called spitters, because if you ate them, you would spit them out.
Mm.
Henry David Thoreau once said that an apple grown from seed tastes, quote, sour enough to set a squirrel's teeth on edge and make a jay scream.
Wow, that is so colorful. I love it.
So the only way to reproduce, for example, a Braeburn apple,
mm-hmm.
is to graft a young twig from an existing Braeburn tree,
mm-hmm.
cut the twig off, and graft it onto rootstock grown from a seed. Yeah.
Okay.
So you would start a sapling, basically cut the top off and stick the Braeburn branch on, and then it would grow as a tree.
Oh, okay.
That's essentially how all modern eating apples are grown today.
I did not know that.
Yeah. In 18th century America, though, most people had no interest in eating apples, and grafting didn't become common practice until many years later. In fact, Johnny Appleseed believed that grafting was an unnatural manipulation of God's creatures.
Oh, no.
Since most apple trees produced apples that were bitter, sour, mushy, or otherwise unfit for eating,
mm-hmm.
most of them were used for the production of hard cider, applejack, or cider vinegar.
So they weren't eating apples, they were drinking apples.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
In The Botany of Desire, author Michael Pollan wrote, up until Prohibition, an apple grown in America was far less likely to be eaten than to wind up in a barrel of cider. In rural areas, cider took the place of not only wine and beer, but of coffee, tea, juice, and even water. Apple cider provided people with something safe and stable and reliable to drink when fresh water could be filled with dangerous bacteria. Americans were reported to have consumed an average of 11 ounces of cider every day, man, woman, and child.
Hmm.
Okay, so back to Johnny Appleseed. Now that you have that sort of base knowledge of why we were not eating apples, but just drinking them.
I understand why school didn't teach us this.
Yeah. It's a lot to sort of wrap your head around to just have to have that like understanding of the biology of apple trees before
like
you even...
botany.
Yeah. Johnny Appleseed was born John Chapman on September 26, 1774 in Lomonster, Massachusetts. His mother died when he was young, his father remarried, and in a few years he had 10 half-brothers and sisters in a 400-square-foot New England home.
Oh.
Wow. Yeah.
Oof.
So by the time he turned 18, he was like completely fed up and wanted to leave. A lot of New England farmers were moving west looking for better soil and bigger farms, so John and his 11-year-old half-brother Nathaniel took off for western Pennsylvania, which at that time was the eastern edge of frontier country.
Okay.
They made their way on foot, hopping from one town to the next, doing odd jobs to make ends meet. Their father shortly after decided he wanted to move west too, but moved to like Pennsylvania, didn't move that far west. So Nathaniel went back to live with the family in a bigger house while John kept going towards the frontier. Thanks to the American government's plan for westward expansion, speculators and private companies were buying up huge swaths of land in the Northwest Territory, waiting for settlers to arrive. Starting in 1792, the Ohio Company of Associates made a deal with potential settlers. Anyone willing to start a homestead in the wilderness of Ohio would be granted 100 acres of land. To prove their homesteads were permanent, these settlers had to plant orchards with at least 50 apple trees in 3 years, since an average apple tree took roughly 10 years to produce fruit. John Chapman realized that if he headed out ahead of the settlers to find desirable, unclaimed land and started planting on it, he'd have a government-recognized claim to prime land on the frontier.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a scam?
Yeah.
Wow. I love it. I mean, I don't love it, but
it's kind of brilliant that like,
yeah,
I'm going to go out and start developing.
He's not doing anything illegal.
Yeah.
He's like, has a good idea. And
no, the government was like, we want to move westward, but somebody's got to make it possible. Because the average person didn't want to go out and turn this sort of wilderness into civilization.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he was doing the dirty work. While the legend that we're familiar with shows him sort of wandering around at random, just tossing out apple seeds along the way, in reality, he was trying to strategically predict what areas the pioneers were likely to settle next so that he could cultivate and eventually sell the land or the mature trees grown on it when they arrived. He would either sell the land or he would use the land as like a nursery and sell these pioneers sort of like young trees, but trees that were already started.
So they could move the tree to their land.
Exactly. And it would be like 2 or 3 years old at that point rather than starting from scratch.
Yeah.
It takes a long time for a tree to mature. So he started all of this in western Pennsylvania in the early days, but moved westward along the tributaries of the Ohio River system in north central Ohio. He would travel with a canoe loaded with apple seeds, look for an attractive piece of land, start his planting and improvements, and wait. By the time the settlers arrived, he would have developed land to sell, or he could use his land as a nursery and sell the 2 to 3 year old apple trees at 5 or 6 cents a piece. Over the years, he developed a routine. In the autumn, he would return to his orchards to gather the seeds. In the spring, he would scout for new sites, plant nurseries, and fence them in with fallen trees to protect them from wildlife. And in the summer, he would travel around repairing fences and looking for local agents who had recently moved in to tend his trees or broker sales as more settlers started to arrive. Then he'd move further west to keep ahead of the settlers and start the whole process over again.
Wow.
From Pennsylvania, he moved through Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. He was always carrying a leather bag filled with apple seeds, and the locals started calling him the Appleseed Man, which over a few years developed into the name Johnny Appleseed.
Yes.
He definitely was not the first to plant orchards in the areas that he was helping to settle, but his scheme of moving along the frontier as it expanded westward was totally unique. This is what made him famous, but it also made him a very wealthy man.
Yeah.
In The Botany of Desire, Michael Pollan says, one could describe him as a shrewd real estate developer. It was not a bad little business.
No, it was great.
If he had just been some rich white land speculator, though, we probably wouldn't still be talking about him today. He was also a super weird dude, though, and people thought it was endearing. That's why the story of his life has become the stuff of legend. To start with, he looked like a fucking crazy person.
Yeah, he did. He wore a pot on his head?
No. That's, well, I'll get there.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So some details about his appearance were exaggerated or just plain made up after his death.
Did he have a special bathtub?
He just bathed in apple juice. Sour.
He's all sticky.
Yeah. He probably was.
Yeah. Okay.
A lot of the things that sound like they are made up are actually verified, though.
Oh, wow.
He was a scraggly wild man with long hair who went around in rags despite his financial success.
So he was like a hipster.
He was more of a hippie than a hipster.
Oh, okay. But he had money.
He had money, yeah.
So
he had a lot of, he was like worth more than what he actually had, though.
He was worth more than he had.
Like he had a lot of, he wasn't liquid.
Oh, okay. Fair.
Yeah.
Okay. He couldn't quickly pull out his assets
in
the ground.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So, well, we'll get there.
Okay.
So he wore shirts made of old coffee sacks with holes cut out for the head and arms, often cinched at the waist like a dress.
Okay, dude.
Yeah.
You have some money.
Yes. He could have a lot of money.
You have enough money for a proper shirt.
Yes.
Okay. No,
he literally wore old coffee sacks and rags.
Oh.
He also preferred to travel barefoot, even in the winter. But the one detail that historians haven't verified is the tin pot that he was supposed to have worn on his head.
Okay.
Some people say that he wore the pot on his head when he traveled so that he wouldn't have to carry it, but it was a cooking pot.
Okay.
But historians say that it's unlikely that he would have actually had a tin pot at that time in history, and the more common cast iron would have been way too heavy to carry around on your head.
Yeah.
So that is unverified.
Okay.
It's possible, but it's unlikely. Beyond looking completely insane, he acted totally nuts too. He preferred to sleep outdoors, even when offered shelter by other settlers.
Hmm.
He did his best to avoid large settlements and always traveled alone. He didn't trust banks.
Okay.
So he had a system of burying his money in specific places throughout his travels, and he often preferred to barter for his trees for like food and clothing or whatever, rather than accepting cash.
Coffee sacks.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. On top of all that, he was a vegetarian and an animal rights activist.
What?
When most people could barely wrap their heads around those concepts.
Wow.
Yeah. He thought it was cruel to ride a horse, kill a snake, or even chop down a tree.
Oh.
Yeah. The fences that he would use to like fence
fallen
in his land,
fallen trees. Yeah. Wow.
He didn't cut them down himself. Yeah.
Wow.
Perhaps craziest of all for somebody living on the Western frontier, he was friendly with the Native Americans.
Oh, shit.
Bringing them medicinal plants and seeds, learning their languages, and blaming a lot of the violence on the frontier on the way white settlers mistreated Native Americans.
Yeah. Stone him.
He's a witch. Michael Pollan says he moved easily between the societies of the settlers and the Native Americans, even when the two were at war. His ability to freely cross borders that other people believe to be fixed and unbreachable between the red world and the white, between wilderness and civilization, even between this world and the next one, was one of the hallmarks of his character and probably the thing that most confounded people about the man, both then and now.
Cool.
Confounding is a perfect way to describe the way other settlers saw him. His behavior just didn't make any sense to them. But most people chalked his eccentricities up to his religion. In fact, most frontiersmen really enjoyed his company despite his strangeness, specifically because he was religious and would talk about religion with people. And
that's, what was his religion?
He was a believer in the Church of Swedenborg.
Oh.
I'll get there. I think it's called they're called Swedenborgians. And they're still around today. There's the Swedenborgian church in Manhattan.
Of course there is. Yeah.
They're very sort of like nature loving. I'll get into more details.
There's also a Church of Stephanie of Latter-day Saints in Brooklyn.
Yes. In Flatbush, right?
How did you know? We're tax free, so, you know.
So whenever he stayed with a family, he would read from the Bible and usually tell them about his own ideas on the teachings of Emanuel Swedenborg, a Swedish mystic with unusual interpretations of Christian beliefs.
A mystic. I'm into it.
The Church of Swedenborg teaches humility, humanity, and a love of nature, with a focus on not doing harm to any of God's creations, including animals, insects, and vegetation.
It's kind of like a Hinduism
thing.
Like, Yeah, do no harm, like ahimsa, I think it's called. Yeah, okay, sorry, go on.
they believe that the natural and spiritual worlds are intimately intertwined, and the key to righteous living is to do good without looking for anything in return. Chapman also believed that the more he suffered in this world, the more happiness he would experience in the afterlife. According to his obituary, he, quote, submitted to every privation with cheerfulness and content, believing that in doing so, he was securing snug quarters hereafter. Some believe that this is why he always traveled barefoot, and that he considered shoes to be an unnecessary luxury and a barrier between his feet and God's earth. Not all of his strange behavior can be explained away by religion alone, though. He had a habit of, he loved children, and to entertain children, he liked to stick pins and needles into the leathery soles of his feet.
Of his feet?
Yeah, because he was always barefoot, so he had, like, calluses.
Okay.
His feet were so calloused, in fact, that he would also walk on hot coals or melt ice on his feet to amuse children.
Okay.
And he would carry around bits of ribbon to, like, give to little girls.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. So there are a few accounts that point to a head injury when he was young. One source from Marietta, Ohio, said that in 1806...
I know where Marietta is.
Well, apparently that may have been where he developed some light brain damage.
Okay.
In 1806, quote, at about the age of 21 years, he received a kick from a horse that fractured his skull, which was trepanned at the time. From that time forth, From that time forth, he manifested that singular character attributed to him. So trepanned means that he either had a piece of his skull removed or they drilled into his skull to release pressure from the injury.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
So his brain was swollen.
Yeah.
Okay.
This traumatic brain injury might account for his signature quirkiness as well as his unusual views on marriage.
Oh, okay. Oh, no.
I said that there would be some scandal in this story. So he practiced abstinence, always traveled alone, and was never married. Many historians believe...
Dude, this is... Okay, go on.
I know. So many historians believe that this may have just been another form of self-denial he thought that he'd be rewarded for in the afterlife. And he actually had said once, when he was asked why he stayed single, he said that he would, quote, not marry in this world, but have a pure wife in heaven.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
A pure wife.
We'll get into what he believes a pure wife is in just a moment.
I can only guess.
The idea of never marrying and having a pure wife in heaven might not have always been his plan, though. One account says that he was actually jilted at the altar before leaving Massachusetts, and that may have been why he left Massachusetts, but that wouldn't explain...
A woman's always to blame.
Yeah. That bitch!
You mean witch.
Yeah,
burn
same thing.
Her!
Yeah. Even being jilted at the altar, though, doesn't explain or justify some of these other stories.
However, the kick to the head, that's real.
Yeah. Some historians and biographers believe that John Chapman actually had a thing for young girls. I bet you didn't see that one coming.
Man. Okay.
Without direct proof, biographers have been hesitant to use the word pedophile, but there are multiple stories and rumors that seem to point to that conclusion. Some say that Chapman said he wanted to marry a pure and beautiful virgin and that his ideal wife would be around 8 or 10 years old.
Oh, yuck. Oh, yes. God. Eight years old. 8 years old. That's what, second grade?
Jesus.
Ew. Oh,
choke down the vomit.
Oh, vomit tastes like Applejack.
Another account alleges that a 59-year-old Chapman made an agreement.
Stop this.
Yes.
Okay. Let's take a small break for Stephanie to be horrified. Come right back.
This is not verified, so that doesn't make it any easier to hear. But so this other account alleges that a 59-year-old Chapman made an arrangement with a frontier family in 1833 to raise their 10-year-old daughter to be his bride. He paid her several visits and contributed financially to her upbringing. But during one of his visits, he saw her flirting with some boys her own age and abruptly broke off their arrangement.
Okay.
Yeah. These are just unverified allegations, though, but they were published by reputable, respected historians and biographers who say that they have come directly from people who would have known the real John Chapman at the time. I did not ever read anything, though, saying that he actually did anything with young girls.
Okay.
That he sort of lusted after.
Yeah. He was trying to groom one of them that we know of.
At least,
but she was, had a little 8-year-old boyfriend, and he's just like, oh no.
Yeah. It was a different time as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was much more common for older men to marry young girls.
Yes.
I don't know about 8-year-old girls.
Eight is very young.
Yeah.
Yeah. Usually they wait until puberty. So, probably at that time, because puberty was much later, 13, 14 is when you get.
But the other story does say that the girl was around 10 when they made the arrangements that he would marry her.
Oh, okay.
Who knows? It's hard. I mean, this story is over 200 years old, so who knows? Well, that was 1833, so just under 200 years old. But at any rate, Johnny Appleseed was a real person, albeit a weird and scandalous one.
Mm-hmm.
Far from being the jolly cartoon character that we all grew up with, he was a successful businessman operating a chain of nurseries that reached from western Pennsylvania through Ohio and into Indiana. When he died at 70 in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Wow. Yeah. He lived a long time.
Yeah.
Damn. That is remarkable.
To be 70 years old in 1850 or 1845.
I mean, that's 3 times the lifespan.
I know. Yeah.
Whoa.
Except being a vegetarian and being outdoors all the time.
Yeah.
So when he died, he left an estate to his sister that included some 1,200 acres of valuable prime real estate.
God, wow.
And a considerable amount of wealth.
Yeah.
And there may have been even more wealth that was never found because he would bury it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the story of Johnny Appleseed.
That's amazing.
Real quick, I just want to say his trees would still be around. I think there's at least one that's still up.
Is it still producing in Ohio?
I think it is, yeah.
Yes.
However, FBI agents chopped down most of his trees during Prohibition because the sour, bitter apples could only have been used to produce alcohol.
Wow.
Yeah. So to stay in business...
That's fucked up.
Yeah. They just went around chopping down all the apple trees. Yeah. Anything that was used in a cider orchard was chopped down.
Wow.
All over the country.
What a stupid idea, yeah. Prohibition.
So to stay in business, orchard owners replanted with sweet apples, and that was when Americans started thinking of the apple as a healthy, wholesome, and inherently innocent fruit.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until after Prohibition. Wow. So it has not even been 100 years that we've been eating apples.
Apple pie is wholesome as they come. Okay.
Not all of the apple trees that Chapman planted were lost to history, though. Trees that produced sweet apples were saved from the axe, and because of the huge genetic diversity and mass quantities of trees that he planted, Johnny Appleseed actually unwittingly created a bunch of new varieties of apples that didn't exist before.
Hmm.
Many of these new species or varieties, like the Golden Delicious, we still eat today.
I love a Golden Delicious. I mean, I'm not allergic to apples, but I'm allergic to the pollen that sticks to apples, so I have to peel it. Huh. Yeah, my lips will be inflamed instantly. Yeah. Huh. Cherries, too. I can't eat any cherries because pollen just sticks to it.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, sad.
That sucks. I love cherries and apples. And I do love a Golden... I only really recently realized that I liked a Golden Delicious. My grandpa used to grow Golden Delicious.
Oh, they're so good.
But I didn't think that I liked them until recently. Red Delicious is garbage. They taste like nothing. That's another variety that he... grew, though, Johnny Appleseed.
Oh, okay.
Like, so not delicious. Not even on purpose. It was just
wow.
He planted all these seeds and then people would eat the fruit and be like, oh, this one tastes good.
Yeah.
You know? Surprise!
What?
Yeah. But he, created a ton of new varieties of apples that didn't exist before. Yeah.
Yeah, I had no clue. Thank you. That was great.
A weird dude.
But
a real person.
Yeah.
Not just a cartoon from the
40s. I like the three-dimensional version of Mr. Chapman.
Yeah. Well, except for the potential pedophilia.
You know, no one's perfect.
True. And that is unverified.
Unverified.
But likely.
However, the hat thing was unverified, but that's what I remember learning.
Yeah. Well, that was I think it was an easy way for cartoonists to sort of be like, this is who Johnny Appleseed is.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think it's time for another Applejack cocktail, and then we'll come back with Stephanie's story.
Yes. Hi guys, we're back, and I'm going to tell my tale of American folklore. So every election cycle, Americans threaten to move if the wrong person is elected.
That they do, yes.
So this threat is not a contemporary one. Far from it. U.S. citizens have been vowing to protest immigrate for 200 plus years. Surprisingly, right? So the most famous person to make this oath is not someone I ever would have thought. Davy Crockett.
He threatened to move?
Sure did.
Huh.
The legendary frontiersman and folk hero is by far the most infamous to make this pledge. He swore that if Martin Van Buren became president, he would never set foot in this country again.
And yet. I love that we're doing Johnny Appleseed and David Crockett.
Yeah.
By the way, this is
so good.
Middle school edition.
I know, right?
Yes. Beyond reproach, middle school edition.
Oh my God, it is. There needs to be some great memes.
Or even before, third grade edition, not even middle school.
Yeah. So the Davy Crockett that I learned about in the early 90s was the King of the Wild Frontier, which is the Disney movie that was made in 1955. I was told a tale of a woodsman with superhero-like abilities who fought at the Alamo. I was told he was an adventurer, a patriot. This whole little matter of him having major beef with the U.S. government was never mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is news to me.
Yeah, so there are a lot of tall tales about this man, but the truth is wilder than the legend. The world remembers the early American hero, part myth, part man. His explorations were dramatized in plays, books, and movies, and his name conjures up images of wild landscapes and coonskin caps.
You know, I used to have a coonskin cap when I was a kid.
What?
I don't know why. I feel like we went somewhere when I was...
Like a real one?
Uh-huh. I don't remember where.
Wow.
My mom is listening, so wow. I'm sure she'll tell me.
Oh, that's so good. Mm-hmm. We need this photo.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know if there's... There's a lot of photos of me when I was a kid, but I don't know if there's any photos of that. Mom?
Miss Brenda, send this photo, please. Yeah. So he is the furthest thing from a politician in the popular imagination, yet for many years, that's exactly what Crockett was. Hmm. Did you know that?
No.
Oh, okay.
I mean...
Yeah, what do you know about him?
This is literally... I know that he's the king of the wild frontier.
Yes, yes. Like, you know his jingle.
Yeah, and that's essentially it. This is, again, just like Johnny Appleseed. You hear... These are the kinds of stories that, like, you hear them told repeatedly, and you get these little pieces of information, but at the end of the day, when you're fucking 35 years old,
yeah.
You can't tell the difference between fact and fiction. You don't know that Johnny Appleseed and Davy Crockett were real people,
yeah.
But Paul Bunyan is not a real person.
Yes.
And the way that those stories are told, they're all the same.
All told in the same week.
Yeah. And like, Paul Bunyan is not a real person.
Not real. No blue ox named Babe. Yeah. Not true. That is fake news.
Yeah. So again, this is another story that's like, if you told me that Davy Crockett wasn't real, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
You know?
So let's start at the beginning. David Crockett was born August 17, 1786. He was born in Greene County in the state of Franklin. I like that your face, you're just like, what?
The state of Franklin.
Correct. Franklin was an autonomous territory, at the time part of western North Carolina, but today this region is in eastern Tennessee.
What?
So this is a scandal that I'm actually going to do. It's on my list of things
to
do.
Okay, thank you, because I was like, note to self.
So it was founded with the intent of being the 14th state, and spoiler alert, it was never admitted into the Union.
How big was it?
It wasn't huge,
yeah.
But it was, I mean, everything is bigger than Rhode Island, but it was...
Is it bigger than a bread box?
Slightly bigger than a bread box, you guys. it was supposed to be the 14th state. It's wild.
Literally never heard of it.
Yeah, because why would you?
As somebody who loves American history,
yeah.
Never heard of it.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So David was the fifth of nine children, and he had a very rocky upbringing. His family moved around a lot due to the fact that they were poor. His father, John Crockett, had a long string of bad luck. He was forced to sell his land to make ends meet. He lost his newly built mill to a flood. He declared bankruptcy on his second home, and he had to move the family to a property owned by a man named John Kennedy, to whom he was deeply indebted. So what do you do when you have a lot of debt and a lot of children?
Make your children work.
Oh, exactly. You sell one of your kids to your debt collector.
Sell one of your children.
Yes. So at age 12, little Davy Crockett was sold into indentured servitude to pay off some of the family debts.
Holy.
So for several weeks, Davy worked as a cattle hand for Jacob Siller in Virginia. The labor was hard, but he was apparently well fed and treated fairly. That is until he tried to leave when the job was done. And he had to basically sneak off because the guy wanted to just, like, keep him.
Well, yeah, because he was sold to him.
Yeah. So Davy escaped at night, apparently through knee-deep snow, and he made his way back to his home and his family in Tennessee.
Jesus Christ.
Right? It's wild.
Oh, my God.
He wasn't destined to stay very long. The next year, when Davy was 13, his father enrolled him in school with his brothers, but the high-spirited Davy, after getting into a fight with another kid, he played hooky to avoid getting reprimanded by his teacher. When word of his absences made its way back to his father, he knew that he was in for a whipping, one that he had no intention of taking, which I totally understand, because you're not whipping my ass when I just paid off your debts, you broke bitch.
Seriously.
Like, no. So he packs up his things and he went back to Virginia, where he joined a series of cattle drives to support himself.
How old?
13.
My God.
A child. A baby. A babe. At the end of the trip, he joins a teamster named Adam Myers on a trip to West Virginia. And during that time, he also goes to work for another farmer. So he's a super hard worker.
Yeah.
He's just like moving around as like a preteen, making money. After some time, he goes to Christiansburg, Virginia for an apprenticeship. But in 1802, Davy returned to his family. He had grown so much that they really didn't recognize him when he went home because he was now 16 and he left when he was 13. They welcomed the now 16-year-old back with open arms, and Davy agreed to stay on and work with his father to help, once again, relieve some of the family debts.
Dude, because by get your this shit time, together.
Yeah. John Crockett was a mess.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
So the family at this time owed $36 to a man named Abe Wilson and another $40 to John Kennedy again, which in like today's dollars is like $1,250 is what the family owed.
That's a lot of money, but it's not that much money.
But they had 9 kids.
But this is also at a time in history when like your kids worked. If you had a farm,
yeah,
all your fucking kids, yeah, like that's why we have like summer break.
But
from
they
school,
lost so their farm. They lost their home and like was living like basically renting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. What did he do, John? Was he like a sharecropper or was he
kind of? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So Davy agreed to go back into servitude to help the family out once again.
Fuck that noise.
I know. Once the family became debt-free, he stayed on for an additional 4 years working with Kennedy to build up his savings for his next adventures or misadventures because now he's discovered women. In the following years, he would fall in and out of love 4 times and father 6 children.
Okay.
Sorry. Why did you gasp?
Just at that age, I just can't imagine having 6 kids.
I know.
As like a teenager.
Yeah, but that's kind of what you did.
Okay.
He first fell for Kennedy's niece, Amy. So that was the man that he was indentured to.
Oh, that doesn't sound like it went well. Yeah,
but she was engaged to Kennedy's son because that's what you do in Tennessee. Hmm. You just got to marry your cousin.
Yeah.
So his first romantic pursuit ended badly. He was actually in their wedding party. And it was at their wedding that he plunged into love a second time, this time with Margaret Elder, who liked the daring young Crockett, but not as much as she liked her other fiancé.
Jesus Christ. Are these people members of my family? What is happening here?
She broke her marriage contract with Crockett in 1805. Finally, though, at a harvest festival, Crockett met Mary Polly Finley, who was not engaged to anyone else.
And bully for him.
So they got married on August 14th, 1806. His life with Mary was quiet and respectable. He bought land alongside his brother, and he started a family. And he worked on the same cattle ranch that he worked on as a young man until, again, he got that itch to move. In September 1813, Davy decided to join the war that General Andrew Jackson and the Tennessee militia were waging against the Creek Indians, who were British allies during the War of 1812.
Yikes.
Yikes is right. He enlisted as a scout for a term of 90 days. The Creek War took him to Alabama, where he saw combat and considerable bloodshed.
What a rough time. Like,
yeah.
In history, not just for Davy Crockett, but yeah. Jesus. Like,
yeah, chaos.
Yeah.
We think that we're living in a rough time.
Yeah.
I mean, we are, but like, it's not comparable.
Yeah.
It's a different type of environment entirely. Crockett shone, but not as a warrior or like a militiaman. His skills were in hunting and foraging. He had a talent for turning up food and navigating the wilderness, and it won him a lot of friends in his militia. His term was already up in August, but Andrew Jackson wanted the British forces removed from Spanish Florida, so they asked the Tennessee militia to assist. Crockett re-enlisted as a third sergeant for a 6-month term, further delaying his return to his family to continue fighting in Andrew Jackson's little war. Crockett's unit, the second time around, it saw very little of the main action because they were days behind the rest of the troops. They were focused mostly on just foraging for food and just being in the wilderness. It seems like they were just camping.
Yeah.
And like being like, oh, okay, we're just camping. Where's everyone else? Hopefully we'll catch up to them. Crockett finally returned home in December 1814, but his reunion with his wife was brief because she was very sick. He was still on military reserve status until March of 1815, so he hired a young man to fulfill the remainder of his service so he could tend to his sick wife.
You could do that?
Apparently you could. If you can find someone else to just be you, you could step away.
Wow.
Right? It's like tag, you're in.
You didn't have to pretend you had bone spurs?
Hashtag sick burn. So,
sorry.
It's sad. The next sentence I'm going to read is really sad after just laughing so heartily. So she died within that year.
Oh, I'm just a dick.
You didn't know.
I didn't know.
You didn't know. She died within the year. So in 1815, with three children to look after, remarriage was a matter of urgency for Crockett. So he wed a wealthy widow named Elizabeth Patton, who already had two children of her own. And together the pair had three more kids.
Good golly.
So that's a total of six for him. And still, Davy Crockett was unsatisfied with domestic life. In 1817, he moved with his family out west to Lawrence County, Tennessee, where he thought he'd try his hand at a career in politics.
Hmm.
In a span of just 2 years, he became a Justice of the Peace, then Commissioner of Lawrenceburg, and then he became the Lieutenant Colonel of the 57th Regiment of the Tennessee Militia. He gave up these positions soon after, citing the need to spend more time attending to his businesses and his family. The truth, however, was that he was restless again. Not long after he resigned from his post with the regiment, Crockett was back in a political race, pushing for a seat in the Tennessee General Assembly. In 1821, he got his seat. And just 3 years later, he ran for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, running against a popular incumbent. He would lose that race, okay. But undeterred, in 1827, he ran again and he won. A year later, in 1828, Andrew Jackson, his contemporary and former commander, was elected president.
Okay.
So they're kind of living parallel lives or in the same era. Davy's mission in Congress was to fight for the rights of poor settlers, because, I mean, that is his background. He felt that they were at the mercy of complicated and arbitrary systems of land grants that threatened their way of life and left solvency just out of reach. His focus was on getting settlers a fairer deal for their land titles.
Okay. So this is like frontier settlers, but further south than like Johnny Appleseed kind of.
Yes, further south because they're in Tennessee, sure. Like eastern Tennessee.
It's the same time period too as yeah, Johnny Appleseed, right?
Roughly. Because this is 1820s.
It was 1833 when he was 60. So, he was 60 in 1833.
Wow, okay. So yeah, same time period. His determination to fight for the rights of the poor but numerous farmers in Tennessee made him a popular candidate, and he easily won his reelection. As a politician, Crockett was determined not to be a stuffy one. During his time in the House, he tried his hand at several really weird hobbies, one of which was the dangerous business of manufacturing gunpowder.
Oh.
Do you not want your limbs?
Yeah.
The hobby that consumed most of his time, however, would also become his most famous, and that was big game hunting.
Mm-hmm.
He grew up hunting in the backwoods of Tennessee, and prior to coming to Congress, he found fame hunting black bears and selling their pelts, their meats, and their oils for a profit.
What does that mean, their oils? Like, I guess their fat?
You yeah, would, their
like,
fat,
melt
yeah.
it down, and then, okay, I get it now. It's like you squeeze, like a duck press.
Yeah.
You, like, squeeze a bear until the oil comes out.
It's just their skin. No, yuck.
Gross.
Yuck.
Sorry.
He claimed that between 1825 and 1826, he killed 105 bears.
That's a lot of bears.
That's a lot of bears. So it was this claim, as well as his fondness for hunting other dangerous game, that made him the legendary frontiersman that people know of today. He introduced an amendment to the land bill that was supposed to help settlers get a fair shake in land deals, but it was defeated. He introduced a resolution to abolish the U.S. Military Academy at West Point in New York because he felt that it was public money going to benefit sons of wealthy men, that they didn't need it, which is
true. He's probably
not
wrong, yeah.
This, too, did not fly. He spoke out against Congress giving $100,000 to the widow of Stephen Decatur, citing that Congress was not empowered to do that despite her husband's naval legacy. This is a guy who was in the Navy and was, like, some high up. And he died in a duel. He didn't even die, like, in service. But they still gave the widow $100,000 of American. Like, he was just like, this is crazy. This is inappropriate. Like, I'm sorry for your loss, but no. This money is
your
public money.
Your husband got himself killed on purpose.
Exactly. Exactly. So despite these legislative setbacks, he was very popular with his constituents. That is, until his opposition to Andrew Jackson threatened to ruin his political career.
Mm.
Yes. He opposed Jackson's 1930 Indian Removal Act.
Wow.
He was the only member of the Tennessee delegation to vote against it. And the Cherokee chief, John Ross, sent him a letter on January 13th, 1831, expressing his thanks for his vote. So that's how he kind of came into my purview. I'm just like, oh,
yeah,
Davy Crockett wasn't a piece of shit. Look at this.
That's so
Look
funny.
At him standing up for the rights of Native Americans.
Yeah. So okay. Many correlations between him and Johnny Appleseed, too.
Yeah.
Well, without the pedophilia, but...
Without the pedophilia.
A very important distinction.
Yes. I mean, let's say alleged pedophilia, but
yes.
Still...
Yeah.
Okay. If people are talking about you, maybe...
There's probably a reason.
There's probably a reason. So, of his decision to vote against the act... Crockett wrote, quote, "I believe it was a wicked, unjust measure. I voted against this Indian bill, and my conscience yet tells me I gave a good, honest vote, and one that I believe will not make me ashamed in my day of judgment." While 21st century definitely recognizes the justice of Crockett's position, his district did not. He was swiftly voted out. However,
surprise.
Yeah. However, the reality is there was opposition to Jackson at the time. He was despised by many, even within his own party, for turning the presidency into a dictatorship.
Yeah.
It was...
Yeah, you said he was, like, ignoring the Supreme Court.
Yes,
and...
I'm just getting to that, okay. Yes. While it was common in Jackson's day to brutally mistreat and slaughter Native Americans, it was not common to defy the U.S. Supreme Court's order that should have prevented the Trail of Tears.
Yeah.
From happening. And that's just what Jackson did. He famously mocked the Chief Justice, saying, quote, "John Marshall has made his decision. Now let him enforce it."
Oh, what
it's a... like, where's your army, basically, is what he's saying. Yeah. Son of a bitch.
And this is why Trump has that picture.
Right?
Oh, he wishes so... he could be that bold.
Yeah. So this, among other things, caused Crockett to remark that, quote, "Our Republican government has dwindled almost into insignificancy. Our boasted land of liberty has almost bowed to the yoke of bondage," end quote. Crockett also routinely referred to Jackson as King Andrew. He called him a despot, and he also said that he was a greater tyrant than Cromwell, Caesar, or Bonaparte.
Wow.
Yeah. So strong words.
Those are strong words.
Got some hot takes over here. Yeah.
Seriously. Good for him.
Yeah. So he lost his election in 1831.
Surprise.
Surprise. However, it coincided with his rise in fame. He entered the national consciousness in a play that year that took his life as its subject. Although it called its protagonist Nimrod Wildfire, the play never referred to Crockett by name, but
what?
It was...
Nimrod?
I know. Nimrod. It's like, did that have a different meaning back then?
Yeah,
I hope so. But it was definitely... His life was the inspiration for this play. He, at this time, began to appear in comics and short stories and tall tales, started to come out about his accomplishments. Everything grew taller in print. His frontier lingo and folklore attracted the attention of journalists. Undaunted by his political hit, he clawed his way back to the House of Representatives 2 years later, capitalizing on his growing notoriety, this time as a Whig.
Oh, Whig, right?
Oh, is it? Yeah. I mean, there's an H in it.
Yeah.
Whig.
It's not actually pronounced that way, but it's more fun.
It is more fun.
Whig.
Whig. In 1835, he was again defeated by a man who was backed by President Jackson. So, yeah. Because he was still, you know, talking spicy about Andy. Talking real spicy. In fact, Crockett became so pissed at this loss that he threatened to leave the country and move to Texas, then a territory of Mexico, if Jackson's vice president, Van Buren, got elected following Jackson's final term. In fact, that's how Crockett ended up dying in the Alamo. Disgusted, he is quoted as saying, "You all can go to hell. I'm going to Texas."
Wow.
Yeah. And he did just that. He left Tennessee in November 1835 and subsequently appeared in East Texas.
Okay, so he actually did what he was...
Oh, he really did.
Unlike most people who are like, I'm moving to Canada.
No.
I hate socialized medicine, so I'm going to move to Canada.
Yeah. Like, this. No, this. He was about it. He was about that life. He's like, peace. Okay. Fuck all y'all.
Okay, cool. Good for him. I mean, sort of.
Sort of, yeah.
Because the Alamo was not...
We
might come back to this.
Oh, yeah. I'm not even really going to talk about the Alamo because it's its own thing. There's controversy surrounding the reason he went to the Alamo. He was there when it was attacked and he died when it fell. He never really meant to join the fight for Texas, quote unquote, independence. But
I was going
to
say, if he was like leaving America to go to Texas, why would he fight to... make Texas part of America.
Yeah, it's very, it's kind of squirrely. The reckless frontiersman could basically never resist a cause. Like, he just liked to be in the action. He fell in love with the land almost immediately, describing it as a paradise and a settler's dream. In January of 1836, in a letter he wrote, "I must say as to what I've seen of Texas, it is the garden spot of the world, the best land and the best prospects for health I ever saw, and I do believe it is a fortune to any man to come here. There is a world of country to settle. I have taken the oath of government and have enrolled my name as a volunteer and will set out for the Rio Grande in a few days with volunteers from the United States. I am rejoiced at my fate. I'd rather be in my present situation than to be elected to a seat in Congress for life. I am in hopes of making a fortune yet for myself and my family, as bad as my prospect has been." Yeah, so he's, you know, he sees an opportunity for life and, I guess, more riches, perhaps. I mean, he grew up poor, so he's always kind of chasing.
Well, that's why most people went to the frontier, was to, like, make a better life for themselves.
Yeah, it's very, it's human to want to do better for yourself and your family. Service in Texas, he thought, would rejuvenate his political career after making so many enemies in Washington. Yeah. February 8th of that year, Crockett arrived in San Antonio de Bexar. Even when he was in Texas, Crockett was still kind of fighting with Jackson in his own way. The Americans in Texas were split into two political factions that divided roughly into those supporting the conservative Whig philosophy.
Thank you.
And those supporting the administration. Crockett chose to join Colonel William B. Travis, who deliberately disregarded Sam Houston's order to withdraw from the Alamo rather than support Houston, Jackson's sympathizer.
Huh.
What was more, he saw the future of a independent Texas as his future, and he loved a good fight. Sadly, though, in less than 2 months, he would be dead. Crockett died in battle, in the Battle of the Alamo, on March 6, 1836. The manner of his death is still uncertain. Was he captured and then killed? Did he die in battle? According to drunk history, he was bayoneted to death while sick in a hospital bed.
I'm sorry to laugh at that, but I just love that that information is coming from junk history. Well, they must be getting their information from somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, they have the big bucks to fact check things.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, they said that he may have been bayoneted to death.
In the hospital,
yeah. But the newspapers did what they did best, creating a rumor mill. Fanciful, dramatic, and completely unsubstantiated stories flooded newspapers. Tales of a brave end, in death as in life, he continued to be as much myth as he was man. Crockett was clearly an outstanding frontiersman, an outspoken Tennessee politician, and a colorful congressman, to say the least. But these attributes alone would not have earned him this sort of lasting fame. His record in Congress wasn't very good. He didn't really pass any major legislation. Everything that he tried to pass kind of failed. Even as a defender of the Alamo, he really shouldn't have attracted much more fame than anyone else who really died there.
All of this stuff is really interesting, and it kind of makes me want to learn even more about him.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I still don't fully understand why he was famous.
Okay, I'm actually getting to this. So books about Crockett, they called him the, quote, ring-tailed roarer from Tennessee. They sold really well. And it all started with this pseudo-biography. So someone else wrote his biography.
Mm-hmm.
Some dude. Who we didn't
while
even...
he was still alive?
While he was still alive. So in 1833...
Without even consulting him?
So in 1833, this man wrote a pseudo-biography. In the following year, Crockett writes an autobiography, just kind of to correct some of the lies this man was saying about
how
him.
How hard would it have been to fucking go ask him?
Exactly.
The dude is alive.
He's alive. Go. Alive and well.
Oh my God.
So people were just obsessed with the thought of him, basically. Okay.
I mean, I guess the fact that he was like supposed to be this like rugged, wild man that could go kill 150 bears or whatever, and then And that he was also standing up against Jackson.
The early stories had him as like this dangerous rebel, like a Jacksonian, like Native American killer.
Oh.
Like they, because that's like what sold at the time.
Sure, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's funny because like the Disney versions of him are more true to real life. Like he's more of like a patriot and like a nice guy, like a frontiersman. It's really strange how he became popular, but it's really just the books and this pseudo biography and then the plays that narrated his life in frontier lingo. And it sort of just painted a bigger than life picture of who he really was. It's a good story. I get it.
Well, and that's exactly the same thing with Johnny Appleseed. And the way that story is told also sort of evolves with different times when certain aspects of what his life was are popular, then that's what people focus on. When people thought that it was great to be like all about nature or whatever, then they would focus on that aspect. And then when they thought that it was good to be like, you know,
a land speculator.
Yeah. But like there were periods in history where that was the focus of his life. And that was what the story that people were learning.
No, it shifted with him as well. Yeah. It moved with the times, I guess.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, that, like you just said about him being like this like Indian killer warrior when like, no.
No. It's like he was always like a scout and like a forager, like way behind the lines, basically.
Wow.
So, Davy Crockett.
Davy Crockett.
Who knew? He lived a very wild life, but not in the way that we learned.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess in both ways.
Yeah.
I don't know if he really killed 105 bears. It seems unlikely.
It sounds like he's exaggerating a little.
Let's say a lot. He's probably killed a few bears.
I mean, that was also a time in American history where there was probably a lot of bears on the frontier
to be
killed.
Yeah.
Oof. They used to kill wolves. They used to kill anything that would threaten their livestock. And
wolves are fierce.
Yeah.
Like pack animals.
Yeah.
Scary. Thankfully, bears are disorganized. You know? Because if bears were organized, we wouldn't be here, you guys. We would not be here.
True story.
Oh, my God. Ugh. They can climb trees. I can't fucking climb a tree.
If you could put the brain of a dolphin into the body of a bear.
Oh, my God.
Dolphins strangely like us for some reason. Nobody knows why, because we're terrible.
Yeah. Do they like us?
They always, like, protect us. And, like, there's all these stories about people being, like, rescued by dolphins from sharks and stuff.
Yeah, they can be like, I don't know you.
Fuck you. Putting all this plastic and shit in the water.
New phone, who dis?
Exactly. Bye. Have fun with that shark. New new fin.
Tim, edit that out.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Tim. It's so funny that, like, again, and I said this before, but, like, these are stories that I feel like I know more about the fiction than I know about the reality of his life. And that's why you could easily think that he was not a real person.
Yeah.
He was Paul Bunyan.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because the things that you learn in fucking cartoons and movies and stuff are so not...
They're so exaggerated.
Yeah.
For, like, dramatic effect.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, they're tall tales. But these people were actually real.
Yeah.
Their stories were really, really crazy.
American foundational mythology.
Yes. Yes. I like this. I think we need to do this again. I think this is a good way to wrap the season.
We could do another round in season two.
Yeah.
At the end of season two. Maybe we'll do the fake ones. Although there's no history to base it off of. I'd love to do Paul Bunyan.
So there was... I found something... Oh, I wish I wrote... Davy Crockett obviously is a real person, but they invented a wife for him
that didn't exist
that was kind of on the line of a Paul Bunyan, like she was like a frontiers woman.
Why?
Yeah,
he had a real wife. He had two real wives
Yeah, two real wives just living their regular lives, like not hunting with him, but they like fabricated. There was like a cartoon strip of the two of them. Tons of lies related to Davy Crockett. Good times.
All right. Well, that was great. That was super fun way to round out season one.
Twas.
I learned some things.
I learned nothing. Just kidding.
Well, should we cheers?
Yes, we should cheers.
America's history is juicy. We just add Applejack.
Yeah. Ooh, yes.
To episode 10.
Yes.
To season one.
To season one.
Woo! Thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach.
Yeah,
this
thanks,
has
guys.
Been Tux Lurzel.
Stephanie Domingo.
Signing off.
Yes. Peace out.
Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important.
Yes.
If you like us, please share with the class. Please tell a friend. And don't forget to follow us on social media, Beyond Reproach Pod, on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. See you in a couple months.
Yes.
Probably August, I think.
The end of the summer. We'll be back.
Bye.
Don't worry. Bye.